Welcome to Women Who Fights podcast. We empower female fighters to take full agency over their training. Our goal is to celebrate and inspire others with the incredible action women and allies are taking to level the playing field. Join us as we talk to experts, uncover prejudice, and champion what's driving our progress. Okay, so we've got Nakoda Davis here with us, and we've read that you're from Northwest London, and where do you train? And where did you train before Corona? Mm. And how's that all going?
Yeah, so I grew up in Northwest London. I trained there for most of my life. And when I turned 20, I decided to go full-time, basically, and be a full-time judoka, full-time fighter. And I had to move up to Walsall, which is just north of Birmingham. So I had to relocate from London to the Midlands. And, yeah, that's where I was training before COVID, and that's where I've been training since 20 years old. And I'm 27 now, so it's been the past 7 years that I've been here.
Wow.
So how did you get into judo?
Yeah, my mum, I started judo because my mum wanted me and my brother to both do something extra after school. So she, just took me along to the local judo club and got me involved. She said she wanted me to learn self-defense and to be able to look after myself. And that was her main reason for getting me into sports. And plus, she's a little bit sports mad. My mum's a bit mad and a bit sports. So my brother does music and I'm a sports girl. So no surprise there.
What do you mean sports mad? Does she do a lot of sport herself, or does she just really into?
She's really into sports. Like, I don't remember there being, you know, an event that that wasn't on the TV, Commonwealth, Olympics, you know, growing up, and me, her and my brother would sit in front of the TV and watch and cheer on all the GB and Jamaican athletes both. I don't remember a time when my mum wasn't doing that.
So you like the golden child because your brother's doing music and doing sport.
Do you know what? I would love to say I'm the golden child, but I don't think I am. My mum just loves my brother so much. I think because he's a boy. I don't know what it is. He's just such a mummy's boy. Whereas I'm a bit more independent. So I would still say my brother's, he can never do wrong. Do you know what I mean? Like, he can never do wrong. So he's definitely the favourite.
I wonder what's that like.
Did you know that you wanted to be an athlete, like, when you were at school? What was the process?
Yeah, I never hear about, you know, when I listen to other athlete stories and you hear about, you know, them dreaming of wanting to go to the Olympics one day, being an Olympic champion. I never really had that moment. There wasn't a point where I thought, oh, that's what I want to do for the rest of my life. Growing up, I wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to be a pediatrician. I wanted to help kids and help babies and stuff. That was my dream when I was a little kid. And judo just sort of was always there. I did it alongside school and then college as well. And as I kind of came to a crossroads leaving college, I kind of decided that I wanted to defer a year. I didn't want to start university. And it was just before the London 2012 Games. And I thought, well, I'll take a year out. I'll see, you know, how far I can get. And in doing so, I was a part of the team's preparation for London 2012, but wasn't in the team. And that kind of spurred me on. I also volunteered at the London 2012 Olympics. And just being a part of that whole journey, seeing how the athletes went, sort of gearing up to it from the months leading in, and then when they actually got there and they performed on the big stage, it just really inspired me. And that was kind of when I decided, cool, I need to make some changes, I need to go full time, and I need to start working towards potentially qualifying for my first Olympics, which was Rio. That was kind of my journey.
That's amazing. So what level were you at when you decided to, is in judo, I mean, you decided to go full time? Like, because that's quite, like, as you say, most people, we've spoken to Olympians who, like, trained for it from, like, you know, 12. They had this goal, just as you were saying. And to come at it when you're 20, that's really amazing. Because, I mean, we were looking at your record and we were just saying, like,
wow.
Nakoda's just been winning several, like, many, many.
She's busy winning.
Yeah, I would say I've probably always been not always a winner because I've lost a lot of times as well, especially growing up, but I kind of always wanted to do more. I always wanted to do better. If someone beat me, I always wanted to beat them back. If I didn't get a medal at that event, I wanted to do it again and get a medal. So I kind of was always a high striver in judo. And when I kind of made the decision to go full time, I was a junior, kind of top of my game at the time, one of the top juniors, and looking promising for moving into seniors. So there was never really like, okay, you're definitely going to make it, but I had a good chance coming out of juniors. So yeah, I would say I was always there or thereabouts, but it was really hard trying to juggle college and doing tough subjects. I was doing maths and chemistry and, you know,
so I'm going to go into the arts.
So having to like travel, take your homework with you, you know, I kind of was making compromises on both sides. And I kind of knew I had to put all my time into one thing. And so that I chose judo at that point.
Yeah, amazing. And how did you, when you did it, were you like, yeah, absolutely 100%, or were you still a bit iffy? Like, how was the transition going from part-time to full-time?
It was tough. I had a couple years in, so I would have left college probably when I was about 18. And I had those couple years where I wasn't in education anymore. Like, you enter the real world and no one warns you for how hard it is. No.
Yep.
Nobody tells you that you've got to pay for your own prescriptions at 19. it was tough. It was really hard. I was so my mum lives in Northwest London, but I actually started training in West London at that time. And I got a little job in West London as well, right by, literally by the community centre where we train in West Acton. I got a little job in the sushi shop on the corner. So
I know exactly where that is.
Yeah, Yo-Yo Kitchen, shout out.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I started working there. So judo was there, work was there, and then I started doing some judo coaching as well, just in and around the area. And so everything was in West London, so it was kind of, it's hard to commute. I wasn't driving at the time, although you wouldn't want to drive all the time from Northwest to West London, but I wasn't driving. So I kind of decided to move to West London and rent a little room. I kind of went through a couple years of just struggling to like make ends meet and pay bills and pay for my room and essentially work in three jobs as well. It was pretty tough and trying to train around that. I just knew it wasn't sustainable, and that's when I made the decision at 20 to move to Warsaw.
Right. Okay. And how did you have people wanting you to join beforehand, or like was it like you knew that you had that opportunity should you want it?
It was a bit of a tricky one because after London, the whole of judo went into a bit of a transition period where there was a centre that was in Dartford, and then that was looking like it was going to be shut down. And we kind of had heard that there was going to be a new centre reopening, but there was a bit of a layover period where there was kind of not really much going on in terms of like official training centres, you know, centralised programmes that are under the UK sport banner, you know, English Institute of Sport. So there was kind of like a bit of time where it was like, oh, you know, what do we do? And then when I found out Warsaw was going to be the new place, I kind of knew in the months leading up, and I thought, right, this is definitely the decision I have to go down. Just for stability, to be able to have that full-rounded support. I mean, I loved my coach and I didn't want to leave my coach in London, but I kind of had to trade that relationship for having physio and being able to work with a nutritionist and being able to be an elite athlete.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And how does it work? How does being an elite athlete works? Like, do they pay you? Do you have sponsorships? How is it?
So if you go to the Centre of Excellence, which for us is in Warsaw, then you basically are in a position where you can qualify for UK sport lottery funding. So this is only given out to all the like official centres for all the different sports. So, I mean, that's the catch, that's the buy-in. You have to relocate, you have to be there. So I started off, I think it was 10,000 a year. It was just, I mean, looking back now, that was not a lot of money. But for me, it just was stability, at least to be able to, you know, rent somewhere cheap up here and, kind of just about get by, but not actually having to work, you know, the amount of hours I was working before. You know, I started off there and as things started to, you know, improve and I started to quickly prove myself as a senior and get more results. Basically, the money you receive is all results based. The better results you get, the more money you get. It's
no, yeah, is that yeah. That's so much pressure then.
Yeah, of course.
What?
Of course. Oh, if you have a bad year, you're looking at getting your funding cut, or at least cut down.
Yeah, right. Is this how it treats the GB athletes? Yeah. That's horrible.
It's pressure. It's pressure.
And like, is there like a vibe of that at the center where you're like, you know, you feel like, oh God, like I've had a bad 6 months. Mm. And then you're with someone who's like, you're fighting. You're like, you've had a great 6 months. Yeah. Oh God.
Oh my God.
How does that work?
100%. I mean, again, I've been in that position where I've kind of just always climbed. So I've kind of got to a point where I got to a good place. And, you know, touch wood, I'd never at that point had any injuries that took me out for long enough, or at least when I got back from those injuries, I was able to perform really quickly. But I, you know, I have friends who have come back and have not performed very quickly, and it's taken them a year. It's taken them even longer. I've had friends who have been cut because they didn't perform, you know, in a year after leaving juniors and only have a year to establish themselves in seniors. Wow. You know, there's been some really, really harsh decisions made. And you can feel the stress that people are under when they're coming back and they know they need to perform. It's a lot, because when you're thinking about how you're going to live and money, you can't put that out of your head, especially when you go to competitions. You're thinking, I'm not just fighting for me here or fighting for a medal. I'm fighting for my funding as well. So yeah. It is a lot of pressure. And it's a bit of a dog eat dog world, I guess, in an elite sport. It's, you know, they only care about if you're good and if you're going to bring in medals and if you're at the top. I mean, that's where you need to be. And if you're not, then better go find yourself a job down at Tesco's or something. You know, that's kind of what it's like.
You did judo because, I mean, most people start something because, you know, they enjoy it and they keep doing it because there's an element of like feeling like progression and feeling good about, you know, what, you know, we all have reasons why we keep doing stuff and it's generally a positive one. Does that take away then, or were you always able to keep your mindset like on a level where you're like, no, like this is still something that I'm really enjoying?
I think again, like for me, it's been a bit of a whirlwind since moving here. I didn't have much time until so I moved here in 2013, and by 2014 I was competing in the Commonwealth Games. Mm. And then winning a gold there just kind of catapulted things, and before I knew it I was heading into qualification for Rio, and things were picking up. I did have a year where I didn't do so well and they kind of pulled me out of tournaments, and you know, but ultimately I think the underlying thing for me that's kind of kept me going is the fact that I've just always loved what I do. And because it is a whole year long, so if in January or February you hit your target, that's it then for the year, you know, you're covered for the following year. So in some ways it is pressure, but it's only pressure if you're looking and you're in September, November, December and you haven't hit your goals. If you can hit your goals early, then you're in a really good position for, you know, the next year and a half. So I found that I've always thrived off pressure too. So it depends on the person that you are. It depends on the person that you are. Like I thrive off pressure and
absolutely. I mean, and going on to like, I mean, so with lockdown, how have you been dealing with? I saw on Twitter you had some pictures of you doing some training at home, and it was like. I mean, it's so difficult. I mean, it's hard for, you know, me and Marina are amateur.
We were eating all the time.
But how did you manage to sustain motivation in order and to stay fit? And how, you know, how do you keep that? So to keep preparing yourself for when you come back, which
for the unknown.
At the time, we didn't know when it would happen.
It was very
honestly, it's been genuinely the most testing thing I think I've had to go through in my sporting career. And I'm not ashamed to say that I have really struggled.
Who hasn't?
I mean, I know everyone has, but I don't know what's kept me going. I don't know whether it's momentum. I don't know whether it's, I don't know how to stop. I don't know when to give up. I don't know.
I've been doing for my life.
I would say it's easier for me because it's habit. It's what I've been doing since I was 6 years old. So to just kind of keep going and keep training just feels normal for me. If anything, that was kind of the only normal thing going on.
So what was your routine? Like, did you waking up and be like, I'm having a 1 hour workout and then this and then that. How did that work?
Yeah, so I started isolating at first with one of the girls from judo, and I think that was such a good thing for both of us because we kind of just got into a routine. So we would say, okay, let's meet, you know, or we were living together first for the first couple of weeks, and then after that we just kind of stayed in a bubble together and we said, right, let's meet up 8:30, 10:30, let's go and do a session together. And we would do that pretty much. It started off every day, and then once we got less enthusiastic it was every other day. And then when PTs opened their doors again and we could train outside, we started going twice a week to see a PT together just to push each other, to train together. Yeah. And actually we're still doing that now. So now we only go once a week because we're back at the training center. But we go and we push ourselves together with the same PT we've been since, I think it was April or May. So we just kind of started something that stuck. And I'm really glad we did because I genuinely think we kept each other going. To kind of have something that little bit of routine, to have a schedule, to have a time you need to be somewhere. I also love doing online classes as well. I did online Pilates for, I don't know how long, probably 2.5 months. I did every morning, I did online Pilates. So that was also really good, a good addition. I did a lot of eating too, guys. It wasn't just you.
I mean, we were finding ourselves opening the fridge without any reason. You're not hungry, why are you opening
you open the fridge and then you look at it and you go, there's nothing here,
there's nothing new.
There's nothing.
After 30 minutes nothing ruined it.
That's honestly so relatable. All the good memes going around, I was like, oh, at least everyone feels the same.
I mean, it's the biggest shared experience.
But
is sparring back to normal now?
So, I mean, we're getting there. So we went back, I want to say we're in week 7 of our phase 2. Phase 1 was only 2 weeks, a week actually. It was with a week break. But we're in 7 weeks of phase 2, and phase 2 is training with a bubble. So that started off first with just 3 or 4 athletes that you're allowed to physically touch. And then that moved into the wider group, which was 9 of us. And then just starting this week, we've moved into, so they split the women's group into 2 groups, so lightweights and heavyweights. And now we've moved into 1 big group, and that started today. So we've been making progressions, and touch wood, you know, so far so good. But it's been strange. Like, you know, I was saying to you guys before, we've had no physios in the building. We're not allowed to see the physios. We're only allowed to talk to them at a social distance. You know, there's no members of staff yet in the building. There's only a coach who, again, has to social distance from us. They can't physically, you know, get hands on and show us moves or things.
How do they say what you're going to do? Or is this prescriptive?
So they have masks on and gloves on, and they will stand on the mat with us. They're allowed to be in the environment, but they have to just say what they want us to do, show us by themselves. They can't use a partner or anything like that. So it's weird. It's
weird.
Not ideal. But I think when you've got a bunch of desperate athletes just really wanting to do something, anything feels good.
Get us outside the house.
I want to fight.
Have they announced anything about competitions, or is it too early?
So that actually only got announced a few days ago. And the IJF, so the International Judo Federation, have put out that they're going to put 3 events on back end of this year, starting on the 23rd of October, I think it is, will be the first competition in Budapest. And word is, that it will be an Olympic qualifier, which is so scary. It is so scary because I don't know if we're there. I don't know if we'll be allowed to compete. There's a lot of rules and regulations, COVID tests before you go, COVID tests when you arrive. And all that cost has to be covered by our governing body.
So does that, because obviously the Olympics have been delayed by a year, is that for the next Olympics then?
Yes.
It's still a qualifier?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Oh my God. Okay. Best of luck with that.
Yeah.
That sounds very
stressful. I know. I don't know when I'm going to be back personally because I've just been a bit of an injured mess. So I'm a little bit further behind the group, but the group as a whole, I think, is just a little bit further behind where maybe some of the rest of the world is. I think some of the other countries have kind of found a way and took the risk, whereas we haven't. Our our federation has been very strict about our return and taken a lot more time than, I mean, we probably went back 6-7 weeks later than they said elite athletes could go back. So some sports did start back. I know taekwondo was back kind of as soon as they could be, and we were kind of 7 weeks behind that. So I don't know if we'll be ready for these first set of events. So that puts another stress on us, because it's kind of like, you know, if other people do turn up and there is a good number of athletes there, they won't cancel the events. That means they will go ahead, and those people will be getting Olympic qualifying points, and we'll have to play catch up. So it's really hard. It's really stressful. But kind of my main priority at the minute is just to be back and be fit. I can't perform if I'm not. So
yeah,
absolutely. You have to take care of yourself. I mean, like, if you're not well, and then you're not.
You need to be on the top of your game.
Of course.
Do you have a lot of women to train with? Like, do you normally train with women, men?
Yeah.
Both?
So in the past we've been mixed, but our sort of federation has made a big push to have the program split. So now it will just be men and women, and we train at different times, and we have different coaches, and essentially we'll have different programs.
That's good, isn't it? That's sensible.
Yeah. I mean, for the men, it benefits them loads, because as women, we do train with men and we can benefit. They have the strength they can push us. Whereas as females, once you kind of get to senior level, it's really hard for a female to push a male in this sport, sadly. I mean, I'd love to give all the boys a run for their money, but I have to admit where weight comes into it, they're just all heavier than me. There's not much I can do.
How do you actually spar with a bigger guy?
Genuinely, you don't. So if you look at the weight categories, the lightest senior men's weight category is 60 kilograms, and my weight category is 57 kilograms. So it's not really ideal for me to train with a senior man, even if he is the lightest weight, 60 kilograms, because he's still going to be heavier than me, and he's going to be stronger than me. So for me, it doesn't really make sense for me to train with men. Some of the bigger girls I know will train with the lightweight men. So maybe some of the 78 girls who can match the lighter boys for strength, they will train. And so that they can also get pushed, and maybe some of the younger men can get pushed as well. So sometimes there is a benefit there. But I normally beat up all the cadets and the juniors, and then when they get to seniors, I just stop fighting them. I'm like, no, you're too heavy now. I can't fight you anymore.
I was just thinking that in jiu-jitsu, like, there's like teenage boys, like, you know, 14 to 16, before they suddenly, they're still going up before they go out.
Yes, yes.
And it's like, oh, we're actually, you're nimble and you're fast and you can't outstrength quite yet. And then suddenly one day they come in, you're like, whoa.
Yeah. Testosterone, like this, testosterone, it's flourished there.
Suddenly.
You're like,
It's bloom.
Lockdown has changed some of these youngsters. I mean, my coach's really? Oldest, he's 15, 16 in January, and he's had his growth spurt during lockdown. So beforehand, he was giving it the bigger, and he'd come on the mat with me and I could still throw him about the place. I don't think I'll be going back on the mat with him when we get back. He's so big now. He's grown so much and just filled out. So, yeah.
It's something that happens so fast.
Yeah, it does. I was gonna say, you've just got to take the digs while you can, while they're little.
Yeah, beat them up before they get too big.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're just sort of going on from that, like, with the difference between men and women, like the way that women train is like changing, and there's a lot of evidence to support that women need to train differently to men, more in line with their physiology. Like, we've spoken to a lot of people who, you know, like, there's a doctor who we're sort of fans of called Dr. Stacey Sims, and she has this quote that says, you know, don't train, women are not small men.
Yeah.
But it's fairly recent, I guess, as an idea. Do you adapt your training as a woman? Do you change your training? Is there like an adaptation that changes it for you? And like, do you listen to your body? And all those sorts of things, is it more prescriptive in that, you know, your coach has like a uniform training program for both the guys and the girls?
Yeah, I think it's, for me, it's definitely a bit of a mix. I couldn't tell you if they were to run a blanket session, would they change it due to whether they had men on the mat or women on the mat? I genuinely don't think that much thought goes into training sessions. And I mean, now that we're going to be separate, I'm guessing that there will be distinct differences just because we have different coaches. But up until this point, you know, when there were joint sessions, everyone did the same thing. So, and you know, there's a lot of evidence out there around, you know, menstrual cycles and when women are more susceptible to being injured, when we can make our most gains and things like that. And I guess we haven't even thought about that when it comes to writing our training programs. I try to let my body do some of the talking. And I think as you get older, now that I'm sort of further on in my career, I like to have more of a working relationship with my coach so that, you know, they can advise, you know, I can push back if needed be, and, you know, we can kind of come to some sort of middle ground where we're both happy. And I think that's really needed because that allows me to listen to my body more and for my body to prescribe training. So in the long run, I am then getting exactly what I feel I need. But judo is very much a dictatorship sport, especially when it comes to coach-player relationships. And I'm not sure we're quite there with, you know, you can only push back a certain amount. And then ultimately it's what's prescribed for the group, what's for the greater good of the group, really, and what the coach thinks everyone needs.
I have a question. So with all the pressure to win and all of that, what happens if you go at a competition and it's the first day of your period, for example, and you're in pain? What's happening there?
Oh, I mean, for me personally, I would never let that happen. That is honestly one of my biggest fears. And everything I've done up until this point has been around making sure that I never have my period at a competition, basically. So learning how to take the pill and manipulate cycles. Just kind of knowing your body and knowing exactly what to expect. I couldn't let that happen. I retain a lot of water before I'm due on. And if I got it wrong, it could potentially jeopardize me making my weight for a competition. There's a lot that comes into it. So I don't remember actually the last time I had a period and did a competition. So I always make sure that it's not in those times and more in training times.
When you're in training, do you ease off the training? Because when me and Shanti go to training and we are on a period, we don't take
anything. So there is, it's just like you get the full blown. PMS, the whole thing.
Oh, gosh.
But for me, I don't compete at a national level like you, so I don't have that consideration to, you know, I mean, that is a massive consideration, having to make sure that you weren't in that a position where you were jeopardizing your competition at all.
And your future.
And your funding, you know, what you do. Like I do jiu-jitsu as like a sort of, you know, I love
hobby.
It. It's a hobby. But I don't, so we turn up and we're just like, right, I'm a potato today.
we just can't move.
Literally, someone's filled my bones. I don't have bones. I have lead for bones. Oh. And I'm just going to probably lie down.
Oh.
So do you actually push during training? And if you're on period?
Yeah. I mean, normally we have to push through that. I don't know if I've ever missed many sessions because of my period. No, I don't think I have. I normally just train through. And it's a hard to start, but then normally when I get
For 7 years you haven't missed.
I've been taking the pill for a long time, so that's also helped. That reduces the pain and that reduces everything like that. So I mean, they've never been too horrific, but I did stop taking the pill actually over the last year. And I started getting into kind of what was a normal rhythm for me, even though I hadn't seen my normal rhythm for years. And I found that exercise helps me a lot. It helps me a lot with the flow, the pain, everything. And the moment we stopped in lockdown, it only took a month of being in lockdown, and I had the worst. I mean, vomiting. I mean, I couldn't move. I didn't train for two or three days. I was in a bad way. And I thought, oh my gosh, if this, I can't go back like this. So I did go back on the pill for a little while, and I just thought, I'm going to go back on just while we're off the mat. And when I do get back on the mat and can kind of do more exercise, which does help me, because lower body fat for me helps just reduce everything down. Everything isn't as intense. When I put on body fat, it just seemed to just heighten and intensify the PMS symptoms, the flow, everything. So, yeah.
That's incredible how much of a difference exercise made. Yes. I mean, like, you know, like, oh, exercise helps. And you're like, yeah, I'll go for a walk. You know, that's sort of like often, I'll move, I'll do a bit of yoga.
Yeah.
But I mean, you're talking about, you know,
Your exercise is way different.
Yeah, your exercise is a bit more full on.
It's so intense. You know, you're working at max. You're working at max heart rate. Pushed with adrenaline as well. You know, you're literally fighting people. You know, at the start of the session, you're thinking, oh God, I can't even do roly-polies here. You know, I'm really struggling. And then once you get into the session, you just forget, to be honest. You're probably more concerned that you're going to leak and someone's going to see it through.
You wear your black gi on that day.
Exactly. So you're off to the toilet, quick check, and then back on the mat. But, you know, there is definitely more to be said about this situation, because I do feel so fragile. I feel so fragile in that situation. And you do feel like, gosh, I'm going to get injured today.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe if I had been keeping a log, I would have maybe seen some sort of noticeable
patterns.
Yeah, that's the word, patterns in menstrual cycle and picking up little niggles and little injuries and stuff. So it's something to definitely explore.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've definitely heard, we've spoken to a couple of people, like exercise expert women, amazing people who I can't quite remember the names of, and they talk about how, like, logging is so important for their athletes to understand their rhythm and understand their, as you say, just like, just pinpoint what's going on, and like, that is actually the first thing that they tell them to do.
Yeah,
which, but obviously, like, it's kind of annoying. I've done it over COVID, and you have to write the same thing every day. You're like, yep, felt okay. Stubbed my toe.
You said something in the beginning that I picked up on. So you said that whenever you lost, you wanted to go, it was ammunition for you. You wanted to go back and win.
Yeah.
So I want to pick up on that. And I want you to tell us, how do you maintain that winning mindset? Because the pressure is so much, and you need to repeatedly perform and you repeatedly prove yourself. So how's your psychological preparation?
I always get this question. I'm like, what do I maybe do different that other people don't do? I think the first thing is, I absolutely hate losing. It isn't always about wanting to win. I hate losing. I hate a challenge being put in front of me and someone beats me. I hate that. I could get so competitive, even if it's just in training, and, you know, someone's getting a bit excited and thinking they can beat me, or what, you know, whatever it is, I rise to that challenge, even in just that moment, even if it's just 3-4 minutes, you know, I'll rise to that challenge, because I hate losing. I hate not being able to showcase all my talents, everything I can do. You know, the only ever times I've ever accepted losing and accepted it gracefully is if I've given everything, I've given 110%, and I've left it all out on the mat, and there was nothing else I could do, and I just got beaten by someone better than me on the day. You know, I can kind of walk away with my head held high and say, you know, that was that. Let's go back to the drawing board.
What do you do? What do you do after that then?
What do I do?
So let's say you've given everything you lost, and then What's the day after feeling?
The day after feeling is like, what's next? Like, when we get back to training, what are we working on? How do we avoid this situation? How do we get better? How do I improve what I already do good and make it exceptional, make it unbeatable? A lot of thinking goes into it. And I get such an energy burst from those situations. I go back into training and it's almost like a fresh mindset is somewhere to start from. If you were going to competitions all the time and just winning, like, what would you come, like, how do you then come back to training and go, right, I need to work on this, this, and this, and this? Because if everything's working, then you're kind of almost stagnant. You're just like going through the motions. Whereas when you do lose, or things don't go as planned, or you kind of was working on something, but you didn't quite actually showcase it, you can kind of go back and go, that was positive, that was positive, that needs a little bit of work, and this was shocking. You know, you can kind of go back and actually look at, so I go back and I look at the videos, I look at the fights, and start to pick things apart a little bit, and then you can kind of, it always gives me an agenda on things to work on. So
that's so good. That's such a good approach.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And it's tough, you know, it's so horrible to lose, but you're right, like if you don't, you know, failure and struggle are the biggest teachers, aren't they? Like with those moments where you're like, and you actually, I mean, we spoke to an athlete a while ago and she said, I actually feel worse when I win for some reason. I don't know. She feels when she loses, she's like, okay, great. I know what to do now. Yeah. I know what I need to work. And when you win, you're like, anticlimax.
Yeah, a little bit, definitely.
Yeah, because like she was like, yeah, so tomorrow I'll be back on the mat and I'll be back training, like nothing actually changes,
yeah,
in terms of like your life, because you're doing something that you love.
Yeah, for sure. I can completely understand where she's coming from.
Yeah, well, I guess it's different for you because you need funding and it's a whole other thing. But as far as like obviously nutrition and rest are fairly important, how do you make sure you're integrating that? Because from what we understand about being training as you do, like being on the Olympic, you know, in that world, it's, you know, you train 5-6 days a week and intensely. Like, how is that? So how do you work to make sure that you don't burn out and you're not overtraining?
Recovery is massive. Getting your nutrition right, making sure you're eating the right things and enough of the right things. Because that was one thing I wasn't doing for a long time. I wasn't eating enough. Having always been in a weight controlled sport and always having to watch my weight, I was obviously growing up, I would compete a lot more often than I do now. So I was kind of always in some sort of deficit because I'm always watching the number on the scales. And that kind of stuck with me. And I was just never eating enough. And I thought, well, I'm full. Like, what do you mean I'm not eating enough? But I actually started working with a nutritionist and logging what I was eating. She was just like, the amount you're expending, you need to be eating more. You need to be eating so much. And as a result of learning all that, I actually ran a coach revalidation session. I think it was last week. For coaches in British judo, just to try and understand and learn more about how important nutrition is for their athletes, and to talk about weight making as well, because it has such an impact on athletes. And in my session that I did, I talk about the fact that I've probably been weight making since about 14 or 15, and that's a long time. So when I started talking to the nutritionist and she was like, okay, you need to eat more. And I was, you know, getting in the day and like measuring everything out and seeing how much I had to eat. I was like, I can't possibly eat all of this food. It's too much. You know, I'm so scared of putting on more weight So first thing was definitely understanding nutrition and understanding, you know, why I'm feeling so tired after sessions, why I'm not recovering for the next day. And I definitely had to change things within my nutrition. And learning how to chill. In the Rio cycle, I had no chill, like none. There was no just coming home from training, you know, lounging on the sofa, putting my feet up. It was come home, cook, like clean, cook again, clean again. Like I was always up on my feet just doing something and I just couldn't relax. And I think I didn't really understand how much pressure I was under in the Rio cycle or how much going through your first Olympic cycle really does take its toll on you. And I was being obsessive. I had obsessive behaviors just to kind of get through like my routine. And I had to kind of learn how to just sit down and relax and take time to rest and not feel like, oh, there's something I could be doing, I should be doing. I definitely changed that as well coming into the Tokyo cycle. I said I had to learn how to relax more and enjoy myself a lot more. This is serious and this opportunity is amazing and all the rest of it. But you're going to look back and be like, gosh, I was so uptight for like 3-4 years. Relax a little bit more. So just do more social things and, you know, not feel like if I go out and I have a drink, oh my gosh, it's going to be the worst thing in the world. Yeah. You know, just learning how to just relax a little bit more. So those two things I think have really helped helped me this cycle.
So was that's mostly those two things that you just mentioned, that happened for this, like after the Rio?
Yes, after the Rio cycle.
2016, 17-ish.
Yeah, moving on, yeah.
What was the, like, the relationship with your body, like, image? Because starting to be, like, needing to weigh at a certain category and trying to stay there, was that a pressure that made you, you know, comfortable with your body image? Because we like in jiu-jitsu, it's not even a thing. Like
someone described jiu-jitsu as a sport for hippies.
Yeah, it's like hippie sport. Like it's very chilled, and
yeah.
But we do have occasionally, we do have to weigh in. And,
yeah,
and,
you have to weigh in. But it's not an Olympic sport.
Yeah, and it's not pressure. Like if you're above, you go to the category above. Yeah. It's fine. We still see the pressure there. How was your journey from that young age?
I definitely like. I think when I was 14, 15 and kind of getting to the top of, it was 52s at the time, and the fear of just moving up was so real. I was just like, I can't, you know, this is my weight category. I can't move up, you know, I'll disappoint my coaches. I won't get any medals, you know.
You're still growing.
Yeah. And I wish someone had just told me at the time, you're growing, you're allowed to move up. It's okay. But no one did. And I think there wasn't a lot of knowledge out there at the time, especially for coaches. And it was actually my mum who got really, really serious with me. She noticed I wasn't eating, and, you know, doing loads of extra exercise and running and things like that. And she just said to me, you're still a minor. I will pull you out of judo if you don't start eating properly and things like that. Because she would always say to me, how can you have any strength to fight if you're not fueling? And, absolutely. You know, my mum kind of had that serious chat with me, and I was kind of like, right, from that point, I said, right, this is the last time I'm going to make it. And then I'm going to move up, you know, despite, you know, the judgment I felt I was getting from coaches and people in my club. And I probably wasn't. That was probably just my perception. But because nobody was saying to me, it's okay to move up, it's fine, you know, it was kind of like, see the rest of the year out and then see where you are. So I was kind of push myself to make it that last time. And in doing go on, yeah.
No. Sorry, finish your sentence.
No, I was just going to say, in doing so, I did ruin my body image. I made the weight so badly that I actually yo-yoed. And in yo-yoing and growing as a young girl, I just came out in a load of stretch marks all over my legs. Can you imagine being like a 14, 15-year-old girl, not wanting to go swimming, not wanting to get in a bikini, not wanting to get in a swimsuit?
You could beat up everyone there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And actually throw everyone around.
I know. If they looked at me funny, I will throw you into the pool.
I'm going to do that one more time. Yeah, go on.
Yeah.
The problem is, like, when you're young, you're not appreciative. You don't appreciate
you don't know what's right. You're still learning, you know. Your elders are your teachers. They tell you, you know, they should be safeguarding you, really, and saying, okay, you need to protect your health and all of you.
But there's so much body shaming.
Oh, yeah.
Like, even in families, they're like, oh, your arms are too big.
Yeah.
And it's like, excuse me, my arms can do so much more than yours.
Yeah, there is a lot of that. But I mean, I've only ever spoken about this now in the last, like, year. I never told anyone about that when I moved up to 57s, how my body changed. I never told anyone because I was really ashamed of it. I was kind of like, you know, it must have been something I done wrong, and I never said I never said anything to anyone. But that did kill my body, my confidence for a long time. And
understand. Yeah,
since then, it's been watching the scales ever since. And again, still now, it's not healthy. And I know I'm always riding somewhere between, you know, perfection and insanity, like just going insane, because it's not healthy to have to lose weight or to have to weigh yourself constantly. But it comes with the territory, so, you know.
Do you think that your weight class is like, it's, I mean, you must think it's right for you because you've chosen it, but like, do you, if someone were to say one day, oh, you could go up a weight class and you'd be like, you'd probably smash it, would you consider it? Or you like, you're with that weight now and that is like what you want to maintain?
Oh no, if someone told me I could move up and keep everything I have right now, move up, I would do it in a heartbeat. I would honestly would. You know, the thought of losing weight, it haunts me. But yeah, I have the position for the games at 57. So to go to the next games, it's kind of sucking it up really for another 10, 11 months and just kind of going, it will be over at some point, and just trying to get through it that way. If I moved up now, I wouldn't be in a position to qualify for the Olympics. I'd be starting from scratch basically.
And is that so, and after the next Olympics, would that be something that you consider? Would you then continue on? Do you want to go for the next Olympics? Yeah. Is that, and then you could move up if you felt, you know, that was the right thing to do?
Yeah. I mean, I was always really adamant I didn't want to go to another Games, that I needed to achieve what I need to achieve by this Games. And then COVID happened and then all of plans just went out the window. And here I am, I'm still doing judo. So I've kind of been a bit more open-minded, and I would love to be able to do what I do and actually go back to how it was when I was little, when it was just about having fun. And I'd love to do that. I'd love to take away the pressure of making weight. And I'd love to just compete at 63s for a bit and just see how it goes. That would be really fun. I'd see that as a new challenge, and I love rising to challenges. So that is definitely an option for me.
Well, I guess, because, you know, if you're going, why would you do the next Olympics at the same weight? If you went for a different weight, then that's a whole new, because, I mean, the game must change so much.
Yeah.
You know,
massively.
Weight. Like, so you'd have to completely reevaluate what your, how you're approaching it and what you're training.
100%. You know, it's different. We do so much work on actual opponent analysis.
And
we do a lot of opponent analysis. So in judo and in my weight category, it's the same girls, you know. When you look at top eight for the Olympics, you know every single girl, you know what they do. You have a profile on them. We actually have a database, like a profile on every single athlete. So that obviously that completely changes if you change weight categories. You then have to start from scratch, and you've got to start, tracking a whole new bunch of athletes who all do different things, have different strengths and different weaknesses. So, it completely changes the game.
Do you go in with a specific then plan?
Yeah.
Do you know what you're going to do?
Yes.
You know what you're going to do, you know what they're going to do, and it's all prepared.
Yes. Yeah. There is so much for practicing it in training beforehand, drilling those gripping patterns, those movement patterns, knowing where their weaknesses are. But ultimately, when you get out there, you are just feeling it and going along with your plan in mind and trying to execute your plan, but knowing that you're going to have to be able to adapt at any point, because judo is so dynamic, it's so unpredictable. You have no idea what the other person's going to do.
Literally, it's so different. We do a bit of done a couple of classes, and because it's got a relationship to jiu-jitsu, because we do groundwork and stuff. So we try and do a bit of judo. And my dad's been trying to teach me how to break fall properly.
It is needed.
So many times that, and just like, okay, and getting up is the hardest part.
I'll tell you something, the only day I tried judo with Shanti, I remember that vividly. She asked me, she turned to me and she goes, why am I falling with you? And I was like, because I'm holding you. I don't want to go down without you. And I just couldn't understand that. Like, I couldn't believe that the whole class was just me falling. Like, this is so intense on your body. You just fall all the time.
I always say it's a really silly sport. Like, who thought that would be a good idea?
No, just throw me again. Go on.
I was wondering, is there any, apart from the Olympics, is there any competition that has prize money? Like, is there any event?
Yeah, so the actual Olympics doesn't have prize money because it's an amateur event. It's an amateur sporting event. But I don't know how recently this started or how far it dates back, but now on the IJF tour, so the International Judo Federation tour events, you can win prize money for different level of events. So it starts from Grand Prix level, which is the lowest amount. So if you win a Grand Prix, I think it's $3,000 you win. for gold, and then 2 for silver, 1 for bronze. And then, I mean, each year it's been changing. The world medals, world prize money has been going up. But I think year before last, the prize money for worlds for gold, I think, was $25,000. So, I mean, big money if you're winning the worlds, of course.
And is that the same for both male and female?
Yes, same for both male and female.
That's so nice
that's
to hear.
Great.
Yeah, and do you know what? It's the way. It is the way forward. It's so great that athletes can get that added bonus now from, you know, winning medals and getting a bit of money in their pocket as well. It's so good.
Yeah, well, outside of funding, you have to earn. I mean, you know, you're talking about if you're not in the Olympic team or something and you need to earn, well, as you say, you were working 3 jobs, like you need to be able to have that kind of income, and there's no way that you can, you know, I mean, being able to ease that with a winnings.
For sure, and it's about, you know, athletes, I always tell all the athletes to start thinking about your future outside of sport, because sadly, you know, I'm probably not going to leave. I mean, hopefully I can do the impossible and win a gold at the Olympics, and hopefully that will change and pave the way for judo in this country. But if I look at all those that have been before me and won world medals or won Olympic medals, not gold, silver or bronze, they've had to leave and just get normal jobs and, you know, further their education and things like that, and kind of go back into the real world and just be a normal person, going from being this extraordinary person that travels the world and competes for their country and wins Olympic medals to just being, you know, just a regular person with a 9-to-5 job. It's hard. There isn't a pay package for the rest of your life afterwards. Once you leave and that's it.
Yeah. Is there any like aftercare support for those athletes to sort of help them psychologically and physically and financially, like, be able to transition?
Yeah, there's been a massive shift. So I think if we're looking 5 years ago, I would say no. But in the most recent years, there's definitely been just an awareness brought about the fact that athletes need support when they transition out of elite environments and into kind of like the real world. And there is definitely more in place now. A lot more. So for me, that's a massive positive. Although it doesn't, I don't know if it eases the anxiety of leaving, but I feel like at least as a first step, there's somewhere to go. And then with that, you can kind of keep moving forward on some sort of journey. But yeah, it's the scariest thing in the world, not knowing where your income's going to come from when you decide to leave. I mean, I think I'll get 4 months grace when I decide to retire or leave, and then
that's good.
Yeah, and then so you sort of have four months to get on your feet, but then after that,
4 months nothing.
Yeah,
4 months nothing. But it's it is. Nothing.
I mean, it's something, but it's not really,
and it's not for life. You know, from then you're kind of like, right, what do I do now? So how am I going to pay my bills in 4 months?
So what are the options?
Yeah,
like, is it? Do judo people then open their academies, is not such thing?
I mean, the thing that I think judo is really lacking is sponsorship. I don't know many athletes that are sponsored athletes.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's the scariest thing. It's, you know, I have friends all around the world that do judo, and judo is really big in those countries, and the athletes are like mini footballers, you know. They get signed by clubs and they have people just lining up to sponsor them and help them on their journey, and we don't have that. I mean, you could class UK Sport Lottery funding as a sponsor, but outside of that, we don't have personal sponsors, and that's a real drawback. It's a real drawback.
Why do you think that is?
I think
because judo has exposure.
Yeah.
Judo's big.
Judo is big. Why? It's to do with medals. It's to do with gold medals. And the one thing that our country cares about is the sports that are front runners. So we care about football.
But CrossFit has so much money on ads.
And MMA. Like,
so
and
much
MMA.
Money.
Yeah, MMA. Absolutely. But they did that very cleverly, though. Like the organizers, the promoters, like the way that came in, it was like, I think it became a bit like, oh my God, what is this thing? Whereas yeah. judo's been around for so long. It's such an, I mean, the Buddha Choir was like in London is like, yeah. you know, it's this sort of in beautifully famous, but actually not. I mean, a lot of people haven't heard of it, but it's got so much history. Mm. And it's been here for like 100 years, 120 yeah. years.
I don't know what it is. Is it that we're not pushing, if we're not doing the right things? Is it that the sport's difficult to understand? I'm not sure what it is. I'm really, but I do yeah. believe that a gold medal at the Olympics for us would change that. I'd really right. do believe that. It would really change the face of the sport.
A shift, yeah.
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 Probably. I mean, annoyingly, because I mean, it's clearly, it's such an important thing. I mean, judo is amazing for like, well, for like confidence, for physical fitness, for like just a you know, community relationships. It comes with just if you're outside yeah. of the elite side, it's just, I mean, like it's those sorts of communities are so important yeah. to, you know.
Would you ever think of going into mixed martial arts?
Or... Yeah, do you want to go into MMA?
Or would that not be on the
I don't think so. A couple of people have been like, Napoda, you need to, you know, that's where the money's at, blah, blah, blah. I was like, firstly, I don't do judo for the money. If I did, I wouldn't be doing it.
Okay. Yeah, that's yeah, yeah.
First thing. Yeah. And absolutely. Secondly, I don't know if I'd fancy getting punched and kicked. I'm not sure
no,
about that.
Tell you. I hate that.
Yeah. yeah. No offense yeah. to anyone who does. Like, I think if no, you can kind of do it, then amazing. But
I think
it's not for me.
You know, yeah. I mean, someone said, like, oh, yeah, you just don't get hit.
Be good enough so you don't get hit.
I was like, no. I use my head as like a barrage, actually. I need to get it right in the way. I have a thing about getting like hit in the eye. Like it just keeps happening.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And it's like my face just gets in the way of like flying limbs.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you wouldn't fare too well. Neither would I.
No,
with my concussion. My
oh, God.
No. Yeah. Now that we're saying that, no.
Yeah, no, we're getting it. You're not allowed now. We don't want you to do that. Yeah. There was a video that you were in late July about BLM, and we wondered if you'd be up for talking to us about it and what it came like, what that video particularly sprung from, and what was the response from the public and all of that.
Mm, I'm guessing you're talking about the one that we put together ourselves that went out,
yes
on British Judo channels, and
yeah,
obviously we put
really
it out onto
great.
Our social medias. Yeah, so obviously there was a lot of noise around BLM, and I was kind of like, felt pressure as a black girl to be like, you know, I need to put something out. I need to say something. But yeah. I again, your people come to learn about me. I'm not that good at conforming. And I felt like when I want to say something, and if I have something to say, that's when I'll say it. And for me, that's when it will have the most impact. And that was one of these situations where I had seen a couple of things that got said on a British Judo forum, just like a forum run by, you know, members of British Judo. And I was in shock. I was honestly a little bit naive and to the situation that there were even people who were thinking this way in my sport. Do you know what I mean? Like, you can kind
what
of
you
accept
mean,
that it happened.
Were they negative comments?
Yeah, I mean, all it was just a picture that went into the forum that said Black Lives Matter, and there was uproar about this picture. There was nothing in the picture. It was literally black picture with white writing that said Black Lives Matter. And there was a whole debate that happened. And in that debate, there were a couple comments, you know, for one of them, get with the program, it's a white country, you know, things, you know, and I read that, and I don't normally read the forum, and someone alerted me to it, and I thought, nah, that's not right, let me read it for myself. And I couldn't even finish it. I'd read a couple comments, and I thought, wow, I genuinely naively thought that, you know, the whole of British Judo is 100% behind me, especially, you know, they want nothing more than
you,
for me to do
amazing. You represent the country, you bring medals, like what on earth was that comment?
Yeah, and it was just it was so unthoughtful and quite hurtful as well. And I think, again, I didn't want to react to that and just post something out there that was in anger. One of my other, like, one of the other athletes, one of the colleagues, a guy called Ashley McKenzie, he's quite a lot in the media eye, and, you know, he's an amazing person, and will speak up when it needs to be spoken. And he just kind of contacted a load of us and said, look, let's put something together. Let's put something articulate together. And so we started that process, and it took a little while to get everything together, but I'm glad. I felt like there was, again, no time limit on it. It wasn't like, oh, quit, let's get it out there before the movement stops, you know. Hopefully this is going to be around for life.
So. And these needs to be, yeah, these needs to be around for a long time. Yeah. It's not just
I guess it was just like a massive like wave of it as well. And like, it was just, it was so powerful and so important and needed. And
but it needs momentum.
Yeah.
It needs to go. Well, it needs to keep going.
Yeah, it does need to keep going.
Yeah.
But what was the response? What did you get back from it?
I mean, we got a lot of positive things through our media channels and things like that, but I'm not sure it reached far and wide enough, but we did get a lot of positive feedback. So I'm grateful for that.
And how are you moving forward?
I mean, I don't let this situation, you know, I've got so many other stresses on my plate with just trying to stay fit enough to stay on the mat. You know, it's like it is another stress, and it is there. And I'm not going to lie, sometimes when you see things on social media, it does affect your mood and things like that. So I tend to try and limit sometimes how much I'm allowing all these things to access me. But for me, how I move forwards is I use the opportunity when it's there to have conversations with friends, with family, and just to kind of listen at where everyone's at. And I mean, sometimes it's hard to hear things that people say because they have just such a different view from you. But I also think it's really important. And I think it's important that people feel that they can say their opinions, and also important that I feel like I can say mine back as well. And we can come to a mutual place where we both understand, look, we want the same thing. We all want the same thing. So yeah, that's kind of how I handle it now.
Yeah, that sounds, and you feel, and that's like, that sounds like a really, I think that sounds like a really positive, like, way that, you know, because considering like as you say, all the other pressures you're under, like, you can only do what's within your parameter, what's within your, you know, what's right in front of you.
Yeah, 100%. And there's a lot of pressure at the minute. There's a lot of pressure on social media, and, you know, you could kind of get dragged into things that you don't fully understand or fully, you know, can get 100% behind. So it's about like staying to your truth as well. And saying the things that you genuinely in your heart you believe, because then it will have the most impact.
Sometimes I wonder whether people, you know, as you say, like, you know, you can get dragged into stuff that you don't fully understand. I think I sometimes wonder if that's actually what happens so often, is that people repeat or spout stuff, and you're like, do you actually think what you're writing? Because like that, you know, if it is, then that's the conversation, and if it isn't, then you need to do some research and actually like 100%. Educate.
If I had a pound for every time I heard someone say, yeah, but blacks are killing blacks, you know, and I'm like, you know, I just have to just shake my head. I'm like, well, you just heard that from someone else. You know, it's like, you know, it's like phrases like that or comments like that that just get thrown around and passed on from person to person. And you're just like, do you actually really understand what you're saying? Or have you actually read up on it? Do you know stats? Do you have facts? Yeah. You know, actually educate yourself. Yeah,
absolutely.
God.
Well, thank you so much, Nakoda.
Yeah. So let's go to our last question. The most important one. Nakoda's done. Yeah.
No fighting, guys.
Nakoda Smith Davies. What are you fighting for?
I don't know why I feel put on the spot. I think I'm fighting for acceptance in some weird way. I'm fighting for our sport to have the best system, the best coaches, the best supporters, the best everything, to give all the athletes a chance to really, really succeed, and for us to have gold medalists at Olympic Games, because we have the talent and we have everything in abundance. So I'm going to continue fighting for that, because we haven't yet got it and we're not perfect, and our sport needs to work on a lot of things. So I feel like for me in this right now, that's my fight. And I know that seems a bit like, well, is that not necessarily a personal fight? Because I feel like I am fighting for everyone. But I love this sport so much, and I'm so, so passionate about the future of the sport and where we're going, and for the mistakes that have been made especially, you know, that I've been through, to not be remade. So I think for me, that's quite a big fight at the minute. And and that helps me on my fight anyway. You know, if I can fight for the greater good within my sport, where I feel like I can actually make impact, then I'm also fighting for myself as well.
Just on the side.
I'm going to benefit too.
Yeah. Thank you so, so much for your time and for all this like information and experience that you've shared with us.
Thanks for sharing.
You are inspirational. Yeah. And keep being so, like, you know, this positive competitive that you are.
Thank you.
And please get well soon, and careful of any injuries.
Don't hit your head.
I'm trying my hardest. I just think 2020 needs to go. 2021.
Yeah, we're gonna see you there.
Bring on 2021.
We're gonna see you there. We expect to see you there.
Yeah. Oh, fingers crossed. No pressure.
All right. Have a lovely day. All right, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Women Who Fight podcast, and credit to Will Grant for being our songwriter and sound editor. Please subscribe and share and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at womenwhofight.co.uk, and check out our website for more content.